From WVUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The large and growing population of European Muslims is smoldering with alienation, and by the lights of writer and journalist David Reif, Europe is heading toward a crisis. This summer's London bombings, delivered by the radical fringe of a disillusioned Muslim minority, have brought a new urgency to what some call Europe's Muslim problem. According to Reif, London was just the tip of the iceberg. Integration has failed. European multiculturalism was a naive fantasy, he says. And with its Muslim population projected to double over the next 20 years, he says, Europe's overwhelming challenge is to avoid disintegration, to prevent a social war of all against all. This hour on Point, Europe's Muslims, Europe's Crisis, with David Reif. You can join the conversation. Could the London blasts have been the sound of a cultural meltdown in Europe? Can it be that multiculturalism has failed in Europe? And why do American Muslims appear to be on such a different path? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is David Reif. He's a journalist and contributor to the New York Times Magazine. He is author of At the Point of a Gun, Democratic Dreams and Armed Intervention. He's written on American immigrants in Los Angeles and Miami, reported from Sarajevo during the Bosnian War, and most recently from Iraq. He's currently working on a book about Islam in Europe. David Reif, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
It's a very, very serious message you're delivering. In an essay last week in the Times, I presume in the book that you're coming out with, you say there's a crisis already in relations between the European mainstream and the Islamic diaspora. Why there and not in the U.S.?
Well, I don't want to. I'm certainly not trying to make a triumphalist argument for the United States. I think that the reality is that the principal immigration to the United States is Hispanic, and there is no religious or fundamental cultural crisis in the immigration of large numbers of people who are either evangelicals or Roman Catholics to the United States. There's also less of a problem, I think, in the United States simply because we are, you wouldn't know it from New York where I'm sitting or where you are, but I mean, the United States is a fundamentally religious country. It's the only developed country that has kind of third world levels of religiosity. So, I mean, if a church-going faith-based, forgive the image, people come to the United States, I don't think the cultural crisis is so great. And whereas in Europe, Europe is fundamentally a post-Christian society. So you get an immigrant population of strong and stern believers coming to a society that's thrown off religious belief in the main, despite what Benedict the 16th is trying to do and say. So I think those are fundamental reasons. The other reason is, in a certain sense, there is obviously a racial issue in the United States, our oldest and deepest wound and crisis in terms of immigration from the third world. But again, on a cultural level, in, say, the South Bronx in New York City, which 85 years ago was an Irish neighborhood, Irish Catholic neighborhood, and is now a Hispanic, Latino, whichever word you prefer, neighborhood, people are going to the same churches.
Right.
There isn't this fundamental cleavage here that you have in Europe. I don't know whether I presume there's some alienation among Muslim immigrants to this country, and there are an important number of them. But I don't think it has the same kind of centrality to either the American debate or whatever is really going on in this country that's problematic that it does in Europe.
Then take us to Europe, David Reif. You say that there, the news could scarcely be worse, and you present a really kind of a nearly apocalyptic vision of what's ahead for European culture. You say 15 to 20 million, 4 to 5% of Europe's population, bound to double, essentially not being willing or not being welcomed to integrate, multiculturalism not working. You describe a kind of social war of all against all. What's the future? What's the reality you see there?
Well, I want to be a little careful here. I mean, I say a number of things in what is a short article, and I will understand that the more apocalyptic things leap out of the page. So I'm obviously not criticizing your lead-in, but I have to say, the war of all against all is
your phrase.
My phrase is a possibility. It's in no sense an inevitability, and in no sense is it yet happening. What you have, it seems to me, in Europe is a situation now where the all rich countries are now being are now full of immigrants. The great story of the late 20th century was the movement of the poor world toward the rich world.
Open the borders, put them to work, and you have multicultural societies.
Well, multiculturalism, in one sense, as a descriptive term, is simply the reality
many
we're
cultures.
All going to live in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to live in that society in the 21st century, or we're not going to do very well. Only very, very poor countries are going to be monocultural.
But you say that the Muslim immigrants drawn to Europe because of the continent's economic success are in rebellion against the cultural, social, and even psychological sources of that success, and they're a substantial minority. This sounds like a crisis to me.
It is a crisis. I also say in that in the New York Times piece that I think compared to the crisis in relation between the Islamic diaspora, the Islamic immigrant communities in Europe, and the host community, if you like, that all the other crises in Europe, the crisis of social democracy, the crisis of the euro, the crisis of the welfare system, are trivial, that these are all questions that, although a great deal of ink is spilled on them and a great many smart people are trying to work them out, and they're inflammatory issues, mm-hmm. as we saw with the European Union, the European constitutional elections mm-hmm. recently, the Netherlands mm-hmm. and France, compared to the crisis with this Islamic diaspora, all these problems are rather inconsequential in my view. Look, the first thing I would say is this point that we have, I think, never in history had the immigration of believers, strong believers, into what is fundamentally an atheistic group of countries.
Mm.
That already would have any sane person just looking at that as a kind of sociological historical phenomenon surely would say that was a recipe for a certain kind of crisis. Second, there's a critical mass of people. You don't have, again, Sikh immigrants to Britain or Chinese immigrants in France are such a small proportion of the population and represent really a diaspora that can keep to itself, that doesn't need, that doesn't have the same kind of, if you like, issues. The third question, and maybe this is the most important question, is there is a specific crisis within Islam. I mean, what's happened is that European Muslims who feel excluded, who feel discriminated against, who feel that their ways of being are not respected and not valued. As they live in Europe. And that's a real issue because there is a deep and very puzzling and difficult question about whether the values of traditional orthodoxy, religious orthodoxy, whether Islamic or Christian or Jewish, can be assimilated by atheistic cultures. Can the Islamic idea of family life coexist successfully with ideas of family life that are in radical and profound mutation
David
in
Reif,
atheistic countries?
I want to ask you to hold that thought, if you would. We want to dig into all the nuance here, and there is a lot of it, but we're fortunate to have a voice from Europe that I'd like to pull into the conversation. We only have him for a few minutes, if I may. Joining us from The Hague is Tariq Ramadan. He's a visiting professor at Oxford University in England, one of Europe's most influential and provocative Muslim thinkers, author of Western Muslims and the Future of Islam. Time magazine named him one of the 100 top innovators of the 21st century a couple of years ago. The U.S. government barred him last fall from entering the U.S. to teach at Notre Dame because the government deemed him a security threat. Tariq Ramadan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for your invitation.
Does Europe have a crisis around the integration or failure to integrate its Muslim population?
I think it's fair to say that there are difficulties and there is a kind of crisis as to the European societies asking themselves what is now and for the future the European culture, or, for example, the French culture, and is the Muslim presence undermining the specific national cultures? But I think that the way it's presented and what I heard right now, it's maybe very pessimistic, because if we look at the situation at the grassroots with many Muslim communities working and changing their perception of their own way of thinking as Muslims, not being Muslims in Europe, but European Muslims, I think that the great majority of the Muslims now are promoting something which is a new understanding of their involvement in the European society.
I'm looking here at a German poll recent revealed that the majority of Muslims found in this poll do not want to adopt Western values. One-third want Islam to become the state religion in every European country. Does that sound credible to you? And if it is, that doesn't sound very integrated.
No, yeah, and I think that when you are dealing with surveys, it's really important to understand in which way the questions were put, because if you are saying, you know, Western values, and it is perceived as in opposition with the Islamic values, of course that the answers are going, no, we don't want to lose our Islamic values. The problem here is the understanding, and it's even in German with a majority Turkish population, the perception is that now, even as the German society and government is changing the law as to nationality, to get the nationality now is easier. I think that now the Muslim, the German Muslims are now much more involved in the society, and you have Muslim organizations and Muslim citizens now.
Tariq Ramadan, hold it there, please, in The Hague. David Reif in New York. We're talking this hour about Europe's Muslim problem. Some say crisis. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Europe's Muslim problem, some now say crisis, and a warning of looming social war of all against all in Europe. My guest this morning, or this hour, David Reif, joins us from New York, journalist, contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, raising some big alarm bells about demographic and cultural trends in Europe. From The Hague, joining us this hour, Tariq Ramadan, visiting professor at Oxford University in England, among the most influential and provocative Muslim thinkers on the continent. David Reif, Tariq Ramadan begins to paint a picture here that says, hey, this is all right. They are, in fact, turning towards something more like integration. I know that despite the controversy around Mr. Ramadan, you've got a lot of respect for him. You've called him among the smartest, most civilized and decent. But you've said that he himself has made terrible compromises with barbarism. Can a voice like Tariq Ramadan span the Islamic mainstream, the Islamic radical fringe? Is he describing accurately here an integration that's going to be all right?
Well, let me see. Two things. First of all, on the issue of barbarism, which I said to your researcher, I was referring to one quite specific thing that Professor Ramadan did, which I thought was a kind of compromise with barbarism in the sense of his famous call for a moratorium on the lapidation of women rather than simply for its abolition. I understand
lapidation, that would be stoning.
Yes. I understand perfectly well that as a distinguished theologian, Professor Ramadan has a context that I don't have. But for me, that is a compromise with barbarism. Having said that, first of all, if there's any hope for reconciliation in Europe between European Muslims and the people into whose societies this diaspora has come, it is precisely in the work of Professor Ramadan, probably more than anyone I can think of. And if you go to his website, to TarikRamadan.com, which is both French and English, you will see an incredibly humane and serious and, I think, subtle account of what can be done. So, I mean, I suspect Professor Ramadan may be a bit more pessimistic than he's saying in this conversation, and I may be a bit more optimistic than my piece suggested.
So somewhere
but
in the middle.
I would point, however, to the fact that on, say, Professor Ramadan's website, which I read with great interest, and I hope quite carefully and regularly, the comments on what he writes are often comments of tremendous protest from European Muslims taking precisely the opposite view. And I mean, one of the ludicrous comedies of Professor Ramadan's banning from the post he was offered
at Notre Dame.
The professorship he was offered at Notre Dame mm-hmm. is that, I mean, here's actually somebody who's trying to sort this stuff out in a constructive and interesting and important way, mm-hmm. and the U.S. government brands him, in effect, a terrorist.
We've just got him for a couple more minutes, David, if
yes,
I may.
Yes, I should shut up and let
well,
him
just, just for a second here. Tariq Ramadan at The Hague, what about it then? Do Muslims have to change their view of the world to fit into Europe over time? Does Europe have to bend? David Reif is writing, Europeans can hardly accept an immigrant veto over their own mores. Is that going to be the reality?
I think that it's a question of shared responsibilities. It's obvious for me that Muslims should reassess their understanding of their own religion and come to the universal principles and to get rid of some cultural readings and try to come back to a rereading of the source. This is something which is clear, but at the same time, it's really important for the European societies and to tell you the truth, for the American society as well, to understand that their society, the European and the Americans should understand that their society have changed and that they have also to understand and to reassess what pluralism is all about. And it means that the constitution should be respected and that we are living in the common legal framework, but we have to promote a better understanding of what we are saying when we speak about citizenship, equal citizenship. And it's much more a question of perceptions than a question of implementing the law.
But is it possible? Beyond the law, of course, law is only part of what makes societies tick. Is it possible, as David Reif writes, that you have Muslim immigrants in Europe in rebellion against the cultural, social, and psychological sources of Europe's success? That is kind of the cultural birthright of Europe.
I disagree with him on that. I think that you cannot take some some groups within the Muslim communities, and by the way, in my website, the great majority is supporting, and I really think that the mainstream within the Muslim communities in Europe, it's promoting, and this is the fact, throughout Europe, citizenship, integration, political involvement, and to try to find a way. I think that we have to be very cautious not to take to be obsessed by the people on the margin and to forget the mainstream within the Muslim community.
Tariq Ramadan and The Hague, we appreciate your being with us. We know we've got to let you go. Thank you so much for joining us for a few minutes.
Thank you for your invitation. Thanks. Bye-bye.
David Reif, there's the scholar that you respect, kind of, giving a muted message on a lot of fronts here, but you're saying this isn't just a radical fringe, that you've got something much more mainline, rejecting, again, your words, or headed into rebellion against the sort of foundations of European culture.
Yeah, I think the problem is, I want to reiterate that I have tremendous respect for Professor Ramadan, and I think I am, despite my quarrel with him over this issue of lapidation and what I view as a kind of terrible compromise, that I think he's a quite heroic figure in this debate. And as I say, if there is a way out, it will be through his work and the work of others like him on the side of the Islamic diaspora.
He's taken quite a stoning himself, I must say.
Yes, he is. But I don't, unfortunately, I cannot agree that basically this feeling is a fringe. And anyone who doesn't like a poll always finds some reason to say the survey was skewed. But surveys rarely fail to reflect deep-seated feelings. On his own website, indeed, he says, I'm just quoting, too much of the internal conversation within the Muslim community, he means in Europe, at present nurtures a sense of guilt, inadequacy, and alienation. That is my experience, actually, simply as a reporter. The other thing I'll say is, and this is a point, again, Professor Ramadan has made many times, many of the sort of cultural centers within Islamic communities in Europe have been taken over. Whether you call it a radical fringe or not is almost irrelevant. I'll give you a dumb example. The neighborhood right around the Brussels train station, the main Brussels train station, is an immigrant, largely Muslim community now in the immediate environs of the station. Mm. There's one bookstore on this main avenue leading toward downtown Brussels, toward the Grand Place and the sort of center of the city. Mm. That bookstore is entirely bin Ladenist and Salafist. As again, Professor Ramadan himself points out on his website, there is a real reluctance, for example, to stock his books. You can find al-Zarqawi's books in this bookstore. And as I say, it's the only bookstore that's prominent. It's the most prominent bookstore in this neighborhood. It's on the main avenue of the neighborhood of the quartier. So that, to me, that's one emblem of a larger question. We, perhaps Ramadan and I might have some agreement about the fact that I would certainly not say this is the essence of Islam. I'm not Pat Robertson, for God's sake. But I do think that the internal crisis within Islam, and that's obviously the other part of this puzzle and the other reason why the situation of, say, Islamic immigrants in Europe is different from West Indian immigrants in the UK, Chinese immigrants in France, et cetera, et cetera. There's a real internal debate within Islam.
Debate, to say the least.
Yeah. And the obscurantist or fanatic or violent side of that debate, the Salafist side, if you will, is very influential in the diaspora. And that's really a point I have to insist on. I wish it were otherwise, but I don't think that's too pessimistic.
The implications of that, as you describe them, seem overwhelming. As you say, this is the number one challenge in your view to Europe, ultimately greater than the sclerosis of social democracy, currency problems, economic problems. You say Europeans can hardly accept an immigrant veto over their own mores, but these immigrants are European residents now, and there are going to be a lot more of them as they raise families in Europe. What are you suggesting? I mean, it almost sounds like, I don't know, you spent time in Bosnia. Ethnic cleansing has been practiced in Europe before. Are you, I don't mean to suggest that you're suggesting that, but what are you suggesting?
Well, I'm certainly not suggesting that either Europeans will engage in ethnic cleansing or some kind of Nazi-like repression of murder of its Muslim population, nor, of course, am I suggesting that the immigrant communities will be, you know, rise up and murder their neighbors. I'm not suggesting anything of the sort. I mean, war against all, I'm talking about a culture war, fundamentally, with violence to the extent there is violence at the fringe, the terrorist fringe. The problem for me is I think there are deep incompatibilities between, as I say, post-religious Europe and very seriously religious Islamic communities with a tradition of proselytizing. After all, it's part of the Islamic faith, as it is part of the Christian faith, to want to proselytize, to want to convert. It's an essential element of the practice, of the conception of the world, that everyone should come to the faith. I don't quite see how we get out of this situation. I certainly think understanding, rethinking notions of pluralism so people can be feel respected are good things in the abstract. But I mean, what are we talking about here? If the version of Islam that the leaders of immigrant communities want to propose is, you know, a bin Ladenist or Salafist version, I don't see how Europe can accept that. If it's something else, the kind of Islam that Professor Ramadan is talking about, I'm all for it.
But you're not confident of that coming.
I'm very pessimistic about that.
David Reif, if we could, if you stand by for a moment, I want to begin to bring our callers in. They've been waiting patiently.
Sure.
Stephen is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello. First of all, I wanted to tell you this is a wonderful program, as it always is. I have a comment or two and a question. First of all, I take very seriously the thesis that your guest is expounding. I think we are looking at the greatest issue confronting Western Europe, and it really is the rise of an Islamo-fascist movement in its heart. And your guest, Professor Ramadan, is a very interesting thinker. He is to some extent in the on the border area, and I think what happens in programs like this is that we end up talking to essentially reasonable people who are not really ensconced, quite frankly, in the center of their communities.
You think the center is more radical than Tariq Ramadan, Stephen?
The center is certainly more radical. I have been involved for years with the Ibn Khaldun Society of independent Muslim thinkers who oppose Islamism, and they are gravely concerned that the center is far too, words like right and left don't make sense, but Salafist than Professor Ramadan.
Where do you think it all leads, Stephen?
Where do I think it leads? I think that we are looking at the danger. I know that you have said that you don't see major clashes of a violent kind. I'm concerned, quite frankly, about two things. One, I think it's bad for Europe that we have a large fascist movement arising, which hates democratic values, pluralism, women, gays, Jews, all the rest of it. I salute Salman Rushdie and the others who have called for a reformation. There will be one, but it will take a couple hundred years. The question is what we do in the interval. But I'm very worried that, you know, the sort of thing that we saw years and years ago with Enoch Powell in Britain, you know, with the WAGs out kind of thing, is going to take a much more violent turn. And I don't think it's only going to be a handful of terrorists. My sense is that you're going to start seeing in Europe, and we've seen it, by the way, done very nicely in places like Denmark.
But done what?
A little less nicely in places like Italy by the government. But I think you're going to start seeing the rise of powerful anti-immigrant, nationalist, European, Christian, democratic parties.
Stephen, we've got the perspective, and our time is passing, but thank you very much for your call. David, if I may, I'd like to turn for a response to that to Hamburg, Germany, where we are joined by Joseph Jaffe. He's publisher and editor of Die Zeit, the weekly German newspaper there. Mr. Jaffe, thank you for being with us.
Hello.
So I hope you overheard our caller just now.
I did.
Painting this rather frightening vision of what may be coming for Europe. How serious do you see this problem of Europe dealing with its growing Muslim population and a kind of cultural divide?
I mean, the cultural divide is quite clear, but let's not forget we're talking about 14 million Muslims in Europe out of a population, EU population of 450 million, so that puts the issue somewhat in perspective.
Does that mean it doesn't matter? It's so small. Well, I mean, in France, it's 10% of the population.
Yeah, from France, we don't quite... Since the French don't count by ethnic origin, we don't quite know. But it is, you know, it's about supposedly 5 million, and that's a serious number. There are all kinds of, first of all, just the perspective. Second, there are different kinds of Muslims in Europe. The Turks in Germany, who number around 2 point something million, are very different from the Algerians and Moroccans in France. They are politically not active, and there's no indication that the kind of terrorism, Euro-based terrorism, that has come out of Spain or Britain, has come out of that Muslim community.
Does Europe have an existential Muslim problem? That's David Reif's contention.
I don't know what existential means, but if you mean that existential means, you know, it's life and death, then I would clearly say no. We do have a problem, however, which was mentioned in the course of this conversation, that this immigrant group cannot be compared to immigration in the United States. And to put it very briefly, people come to America to want to become Americans, to make it. Immigrants and Muslim immigrants to Europe, you know, very roughly generalized, don't necessarily come here to make it and to become Germans, French, or what have you. They may carry passports, but it's not the kind of U.S. immigration that has taken place for the past 200 years.
And I wonder why. I want to come back and look at that, if we may, Joseph Jaffe. If you can hold on for just a moment, we have to take a short break here. David Reif in New York, Joseph Jaffe, editor of Die Zeit in Hamburg, Germany. Listeners, we're talking about Europe's Muslim problem. Some now say crisis. You can join us. Must Europe's Muslim population be, by definition, in conflict with Europe's cultural tradition, the Enlightenment, the tradition of liberal thought, or is assimilation and integration still the goal? Is it still possible? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at babsoncapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Europe's Muslim problem. Some now say crisis, including our guest today from New York, David Reif, journalist, contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, author of a list of books as long as your arm. He's been out covering wars and cultures and immigrants. He joins us this hour from New York. We're joined as well from Hamburg, Germany, by Joseph Jaffe, publisher and editor of Die Zeit, the weekly German newspaper. You can join us as well. What do you think? Can it be that multiculturalism has failed in Europe? And can Europe learn from the United States on this front? What can it learn? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John is calling from Amherst, New York. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a fascinating conversation. And if you just juxtapose with the assimilation that Arabs have really made in our country, there are still some. But Europe really has only itself to blame. You know, this influx of Northern European or North Africans coming into Europe was a result of colonialism on the part of, say, the French. I'm going to say specific to them. They were having their problems in Algeria and things like that, and a lot of people who were sympathetic to France were more or less brought to France because they would have faced repression in their own homeland.
But still, why not open the French arms then, see the future as multicultural, and make it work?
That's another one of my points. The Europeans are the true racists because these societies, these Islamic societies, are really societies within the French, the German, and what they did was they brought a lot of these people in to do the work that they didn't want to do.
John, let us pick that up, and we've got it, and I thank you for your call. And I must say, David Reif, Joseph Jaffe, looking at the statistics here, it is quite remarkable the difference between European Muslims generally and American. I mean, British Muslims, 3 times more likely to be unemployed than the wider population, low rates of civic participation, as many as 26% British Home Office finds do not feel loyal to Britain. American Muslims, we're looking at a Zogby poll here, they have fared well, and I'm not saying Arab Americans, Muslim Americans, 59% at least in undergraduate education, the most highly educated group in America, the richest Muslim community in the world, 4 out of 5 earning more than $25,000 a year, 1 in 3 more than $75,000. In terms of civic participation, 82% registered to vote. I mean, even 65% favor lowering the income tax. That's about as American as you can get lately. This looks like a very, very different picture from Europe's Muslims, Joseph Jaffe. Is Europe to blame somehow? Is it European racism that's held Muslims at bay from integration, from the multicultural ideal?
I'm always very careful about terms like racism, but I'll say this. There are at least 2 explanations in my mind, and they're both supply-side and demand-side, as it were. Mm. The kind of Muslims, or in general, the kind of immigrants that come to Europe, come here to escape, to call it the social welfare fleshpots of Europe, and so not necessarily the kind of powerful incentive as in the United States to make it. On the other side, on the European side, we at first didn't even realize what was happening. You know, we thought we were bringing these guest workers and they'll go away.
Right.
And the way, and add to that what you might call the pernicious part of the multicultural ideal, which said, well, we'll leave them alone, we let them do what they want to do, we let them live in their ghettos, and we will not impose upon them, or what we call assimilation, we won't turn them into Germans, French, Italians, or what have you. So there is So there is, if you want to apportion fault, there's fault on both sides, and we have now reached the end of the, what you might call the permissive multicultural road, and we have now realized these people are here to stay, they will grow, and we will have to do, integrate and assimilate them to the point to which they don't give up their food and their habits or what have you, but to the point at which they become Europeans, meaning that they sign on to the creed, if you wish, which is liberal, democratic, enlightenment, etc. And that is what the future is going to be like, somewhat less permissive, but certainly a long, long way from racism.
So kind of a prodding to become Europeans. David Reif, will that work? You say Europeans imagined that Muslims would simply become that over time, that they would come to accept the values of the new countries. They haven't. Joseph Jaffe is describing, you know, broadly, Europe now preparing to push Muslims toward that end. Will that work?
Well, I don't know what will work and what won't. There's a famous line of Cicero's where he says that he doesn't understand when two soothsayers meet each other in the road why they don't burst out laughing.
Right.
So, I mean, I haven't a clue about whether it will work or not. I think Mr. Jaffe is absolutely correct in saying that from a European government or institutional point of view, the age of permissive multiculturalism is over. The problem I have is with if you like, his optimism I'm the pessimist on your program, but then that's sort of why you invite me when you do. The problem I have is that I don't think this European liberal charter to which Mr. Jaffe alludes is even compelling to a great many Europeans. So I'm rather less optimistic than he about its successful imposition on Muslims. After all, 17% of the French electorate can reliably be counted on to vote for the National Front. I respect Mr. Jaffe's reluctance to use words like racism, and I share his reluctance to do so. But, I mean, that is a racist party, and it compels the allegiance of a great many people. The Vlaams Belang in Flanders can make even larger claims. So,
and we hear Europeans not forgetting about the story, of course, of the Dutch filmmaker Theo van Gogh, accosted in the street by a European Muslim who shot him 6 times. As van Gogh pleaded, "We can still talk about it. Don't do it." Shot him anyway, nearly cut his head off. Said to his mother during the trial, "I do not feel your pain." I mean, these are tough images to deal with. I want to get another caller here. Lou is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Lou. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I guess my question is, you know, I mean, I'm not advocating genocide or anything like that.
Well, that's good.
If folks move into an area, okay, I mean, you would think the idea is moving in to try to assimilate and try to, you know, absorb, become part of the culture. I mean,
what if they don't want to? What if they don't like what they see as a godless European culture?
That's my question. I mean, just like I think what Tony Blair is trying to advocate. I mean, can we just simply ask them to leave? I mean, if they don't want to be a part of our culture and our society, can't we just ask them to leave?
Let us pick it up, Lou. Joseph Jaffe, Tony Blair says the rules of the game has changed. Lou makes it a more pointed question. Can't we, or in this case, you, just ask them to leave? Is that on the boards, or is Europe just going to have to figure out a way to deal with this?
No, I mean, we can't ask them to leave. But what the British are now doing is, and I think that's within the ken of the permissible of a liberal state, is to say those who incite to violence, those who perpetrate or talk about perpetrating or encourage perpetrating terrorism, etc., will have to go. And I think that is covered, as it were, by the liberal dispensation. But certainly you can't go and expel the multitudes from Europe. But let me add another thought.
Yes.
You earlier in the talk, you talked about, hey, does Europe have to change?
Mm-hmm.
And I would say yes, but not in the way that it would accept the veto power of its Muslim immigrants. But
so how so?
Europe would have to change to give people a stake in the society, which means it will have to become more like America. It will have to offer opportunities, chances, bring people into the work process, bring people in the educational process. Just generally add incentives to the pressure to become, Italian, Germans, French, etc., etc. And that's where something is missing in Europe. You can't just, if you're an immigrant, you can't just start at the bottom by opening up a little store like the Koreans do in New York City. You have to pass zillions of exams and tests and permits, etc. So that's where Europe would have to change, and for its own sake, too, I would say.
So open it up to have a chance. David Reif, you just got a couple more minutes here. Can you see that path opening up? Europe becoming more open, more like the United States, Europe's Muslims responding to that with integration, assimilation, and the problem goes away?
Well, I doubt Mr. Jaffe thinks the problem will go away.
Becomes manageable, then, excuse me.
I think that it... All of this talk, Europe certainly has to change in a lot of ways, and economically its current system is not sustainable, whether you approve of it or you don't. But I think, in all candor, that there is a crisis within Islam. There's a very specific crisis debate within Islam. One of your earlier callers talked about needing a reformation, the fellow who's involved in the Ibn Khaldun Society.
Yes.
These are, if you like, pre-Reformation times in Islam. There are no images, no historical images exactly apt, but grossly put. And I think, in a way, the crisis in Europe reflects that crisis. That's why a fellow like Ramadan, Professor Ramadan, is so important, because he represents, if you like, this reformist move. But
don't read the Quran
much,
so literally, he says. We have to move beyond.
Well, that's precisely the argument that we had in the Reformation, in the transformation of Christianity over the centuries, was precisely to get away from literalism. Not that you know it from some people in the United States, but that's another conversation.
So the question may be whether these two trains are running at speeds that are compatible.
I think that's the problem. I also would make one point, if I may, that I think is important.
We've just got 20 seconds here.
Mm-hmm. Is that it may be true that Muslims, as Professor Jaffe says, still represent a fairly small proportion of the population. They represent a huge proportion of the urban population, and that's a very important fact.
And with that, we're going to have to leave it this hour, but we're very grateful to both of you. Joseph Jaffe, publisher and editor of Die Zeit, joining us from Hamburg, Germany. Thank you very much for being here.
It was a pleasure.
And David Reif, journalist, contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, author of A Bed for the Night at the Point of a Gun and Slaughterhouse. Thank you so much for joining us. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me on.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, the story of one man's discovery of his father's secret life in the CIA. This is On Point. For the writer John Richardson, family history is the history of the 20th century. His father, Jack, was a founding member of the CIA who worked Cold War hotspots in the 1940s and 50s. He was Saigon CIA chief during the Vietnam War. His family joined him at his postings, but the truth about his job stayed hidden from his children. In 1963, his cover was blown, intentionally, in Vietnam. Jack Richardson was the first CIA operative known to have been outed by fellow Americans. He died in 1998. His son John writes about this secret life in a new memoir, My Father, the Spy. In this radio diary, John Richardson remembers his father and the secrets that bound them together.
I didn't know what my father did until I was 14. As a kid, I thought he was what they told me, which was special assistant to the ambassador. He went off to the embassy in a suit. I found out that my father was in the CIA when I was a kid in school in the States, and he had gotten an assignment to Korea, and he sat me down in the study and said, "You're old enough to know what I do for a living. I'm in the CIA, and the thing about being special assistant to the ambassador is just a cover story." I was kind of nonplussed. My main concern at the moment was, you want me to stay in boarding school? What's that about? But I did go looking for more evidence, and I found a gun in his bureau with our initials carved into them, JHR, which, being a juvenile delinquent wannabe, I went out and shot in the woods. It promptly disappeared. There was a heavy feeling of darkness a lot of times in the house. There was a sense of responsibility and importance, and the news played a big role, and he would brood over a foreign policy turn. And I saw the foreign policy as almost an enemy, so that's something that brought darkness into the house. I wanted to sort of not think about that stuff. I cared about rock and roll. I cared about Jimi Hendrix and novels I really liked to read. I came home one day and my father called me into his study and had a piece of paper in his hand and said, "Son, I have a letter here from military intelligence saying that you're a known user of LSD. All hell broke loose at that point. They took me to the psychiatrist, and then we sort of mutually decided that I would leave home. My father was the first CIA agent that was outed by our own side. In Vietnam, he participated a bit reluctantly in the overthrow of Ngo Dinh Diem at the behest of John Kennedy. He was sort of standing in the middle between military and CIA people who thought we should support the president, Ngo Dinh Diem, and another group of people, Kennedy's advisors, who thought we should support a coup against Diem. Kennedy couldn't make up his mind what to do, and in the split between his leaders, Kennedy sent out a new ambassador, and my father clashed with this ambassador. And in the middle of his clash with Ambassador Lodge, suddenly his name appeared in the press in a paper in Washington, D.C. It said that he had disobeyed orders, direct orders from Ambassador Lodge. It was based on a single high official source who was not named. Immediately, my father was withdrawn from Vietnam. His cover was blown. He came home. He told my mom that her emergency instructions were in the house safe, and he took a limousine to the plane. My father's exposure in the press was very similar to the one that's recently happened, the Valerie Plame incident. It was a time of war when a policy dispute split the government and people could not agree on what to do next. And one side jammed its way forward with this. What happened after that is a month after my father was left, Jem was assassinated by the generals who we had encouraged. And from then on, we were involved karmically and strategically in propping up South Vietnam in a way that we had never been before. One thing I've done is spend a lot of time thinking about secrets and what's important about them and why people are so fascinated by them, because people have this fetish of secrets and secret lives. And I eventually went out the other end of that and turned my back on the beauty of secrets and started to think that understanding things, analyzing things, putting things in sequence and drawing the lines between events is a lot more important to one's understanding of life and your father.
John Richardson talking about his father Jack, former CIA station chief in Vietnam. Richardson's new book is My Father, the Spy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.